This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. A Single Man, the first feature film directed and co-written by fashion designer Tom Ford, came out this week on DVD. On today's Fresh Air, we'll listen back to Terry's interview with Tom Ford, and, a little later, with the movie's star, Colin Firth. A Single Man is based on the 1964 novel by Christopher Isherwood. The movie made Time magazine's list of the year's 10 best films, and Entertainment Weekly's film critic, Owen Gleiberman, wrote that Ford was a born filmmaker with a rapturous eye. Ford is the former creative director of Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent, where he was known for his glamorous collections and also for his provocative ad campaigns. A Single Man is set in L.A. in 1962. And stars Colin Firth as George, a college professor in his 50s, whose younger, longtime partner has just been killed in a car crash. George is so heartbroken, he's buying bullets for his gun and preparing to kill himself. But as he does so, he continues to teach and to confide in his old friend, played by Julianne Moore. In this scene, from the beginning of A Single Man, George is getting out of bed, dressing and preparing for the day. This is what he's thinking.
Waking up begins with saying am and now. For the past 8 months, waking up has actually hurt. Cold realization that I'm still here slowly sets in. I was never terribly fond of waking up. I was never one to jump out of bed and greet the day with a smile like Jim was. I used to want to punch him sometimes in the morning. He was so happy. I always used to tell him that only fools greet the day with a smile, that only fools could possibly escape the simple truth, that now isn't simply now. It's a cold reminder. One day later than yesterday, 1 year later than last year, and that sooner or later, it will come. He used to laugh at me and then give me a kiss on the cheek. It takes time in the morning for me to become George. Time to adjust to what is expected of George and how he is to behave. By the time I've dressed and put the final layer of polish on the now slightly stiff but quite perfect George, I know fully what part I'm supposed to play.
That's Colin Firth in the opening of A Single Man. Tom Ford, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
I think one of the things that will surprise people seeing this opening scene is that we would likely think of you, since fashion is the world that you're from, as waking up in the morning and thinking, oh boy, what fabulous clothes will I wear today? What fun I will have presenting myself to the outer world, as opposed to the effort and pain that this character is feeling in putting himself together to be in the world and present himself to the world.
I think a lot of us do that. I think that our public face is often armor. And this character is held together. His inner world and his outer world are directly related. He's suffering inside. So what's going on inside this man is very, very different than what's going on the outside. And he feels that if he can just stay in control of everything on the outside and construct a certain armor that is his public persona, that he will be safe inside and he'll be able to hold himself together. And that comes literally from the book, where Christopher Isherwood talks about the fact that if someone called him early in the morning, they wouldn't know that it was, you know, that it was George. They wouldn't recognize his voice, that it took him a while to prepare to become the George that was expected of him. And so I interpreted it slightly differently in the film, but very much, I believe, follows the story in the book.
In your movie, A Single Man, George, the main character, is bereft after his longtime companion dies. And at the beginning of the movie, we get the point that he's thinking of ending his life. He has a gun.
Yes.
And he's thinking of suicide. And there's a scene where he takes his gun, he goes to his bed, fluffs a couple of pillows behind him, puts the gun in his mouth, realizes the pillows aren't arranged quite right. They're not quite comfortable. And he turns around, repositions them, still not quite right. Puts the gun in his mouth again. Not quite right. And we realize,
well, the real intention of that is, you know, he doesn't want to make a mess.
Well, I think he's also, you know, he wants to get comfortable. He wants to be in the right position. And finally, I think he's not quite ready to do the act. But I'd like you to talk about that scene and what it meant to you and how you shot it.
Sure. Well, first of all, the idea of suicide is something that I invented because it's not part of the book. You know, the book is a beautiful, beautiful interior monologue, and there really is no plot to speak of in the book. It ambles along, and our interest is held because George's thoughts are so interesting. His insight holds us, and his humor, and often dark humor. And when I set out to make this into a film, you know, when you decide you want to make a film, you start listening to everything that anyone has to say about filmmaking and reading everything. And there's a maxim about film being a visual medium, and so you need to make, in a sense, a silent movie and layer on dialogue. So I had to create scenes that I had to create a plot, and I felt that what better way to show the meaning of life and to show someone trying to move forward and live in the present than to think that this is your last day on the planet. So George decides to kill himself. He decides that he does not want to live any longer, and because of this, of course, he starts to see the world in a very, very different way, and the beauty of the world starts to pull on him. But the particular scene that you're talking about, George's character, this is somebody who is hyper-organized, and as I was saying, his inner world is directly related to his outer world, and he likes control. So this is someone who is not going to leave the world until everything is taken care of. You know, his suit is laid out that he wants to be buried in, his bills are paid, everything's organized, and he also is thinking about, where am I going to kill myself? How am I going to do it? I love my housekeeper. I don't want to make a mess. Should I do this on the bed? No, it's going to get, the sheets are going to get all covered in blood. The wall is going to be covered in blood. Maybe I should try it in the shower. So I go to the shower. No, that's not going to work because after I shoot myself, I'm going to fall. There's going to be blood all over everything. So, you know, I'll get out, and I don't know how much we want to give away, but he starts rehearsing and practicing, trying to figure out the most practical way to kill himself. It's meant that he is not going to kill. I mean, you know, maybe it didn't translate in the film, but he's just simply practicing at that point because he's really planning on going to dinner with his best friend after he's practiced and figured out what he's going to do later on in the evening. Really, in a sense, to say goodbye to her.
Let's talk about the look that you wanted for your film. It's set in 1962. Talk about how you wanted to dress Colin Firth's character and Julianne Moore's.
Well, I wanted to dress Colin Firth's character in a way that would be appropriate to who he was as a personality. So I thought, okay, this is a guy who is not dependent on his salary as a teacher. This is a guy who comes from a fairly wealthy background in England. He went to, you know, private schools or public schools, they're called in England. And he's teaching at a public college because he feels this is the right thing to do. So this guy probably has his clothes made, you know, when he's home in London, and he probably gets them from Savile Row, from the same tailor that his father went to. He's a professor, so what's he wearing? He's going to be wearing brown tweed. He's not going to be wearing gray. He's not going to be wearing, you know, navy blue wool serge. He's a professor. So I also tried to calculate when would he have had these suits made. You know, the English are quite, even still to this day, I think, thrifty with their clothing, at least the old school English. And so I thought, okay, when did he have this suit made? I calculated he probably had it made maybe, let's say, 1957, blah, blah, blah. In fact, I even sewed a label inside Colin's suit, as one would get at a Savile Row tailor, with his name and the date that the suit was made. And so I really gave a lot of thought to who this guy is. This is a guy who, as I said, really holds himself together by his outer appearance. It holds inside. He's this deeply romantic and at this particular moment, you know, terribly, terribly sorrowful man. But on the surface, you wouldn't know that. Julianne Moore's character is a woman who has lived her life as a beautiful woman in our culture. And, you know, we objectify women. And, of course, I, as a fashion designer, could say that I've been a part of that. But our entire culture treats beautiful women in a certain way. A beautiful woman in our culture, and I would like to say, you know, this was different in 1962, but it still exists today. I know a lot of these women. Treats women in a different way, meaning that if you're a beautiful woman, you're incredibly powerful within our culture. The world operates differently for you. Then, at a moment in time, and it has nothing to do with you. It's like the carpet is just ripped out from under you. And the way that you've operated in the world no longer works. So Julianne's character is
because you're older.
Struggling. Well, yes, and it's terrible. And a woman who has lived her life that way can often find herself in a moment where she cannot see her future. Now, she will have a future, but she's got to alter the way she moves through the world. So Julianne's character is at that moment in time, and she's still clinging to what she knows, to what's gotten her to where she is. She's thinking if she has the most beautiful house and the latest car and the most perfect eye makeup and she's up on top of everything and she's playing Serge Gainsbourg way before anyone else is because she spends the summers in the south of France and so she's listening to this music, she's brought it back. Her clothes, for example, her dress, and we're in 1962, is really more 1963 or 4. It's very graphic. It's really pop art before pop art or when pop art was just starting to happen. And I rationalized this by thinking, all right, she lives in Los Angeles. Who is she going to know in L.A. at that period of time? Rudy Gernreich was living in Los Angeles, and he was about to explode on the scene with these very graphic clothes. And I thought, okay, maybe she's his muse, or maybe she's spending a lot of time with him and she's ahead of the curve. But everything in her house, everything about her is in support of her character. It is a layer of veneer, but it is something that's there to support her character. When we see her making up her face, we see her unmade eye on one side of the screen. She's looking in a magnifying mirror, and we have a shot looking at that. And then we see, a fully drawn eye on the other side. And it's her art, and it's her artifice, and it's who she really is on one side, and it's the face she puts on to the outer world on the other side of our screen. And that's the same with George. They're both putting on layers, veneers, armor to get through their day, as I think many of us do.
How did you realize you were interested in fashion, in working in the fashion world?
Well, I think it took me a while to feel comfortable admitting to myself that I cared about fashion.
Why? Why was it hard?
Well, as a tiny kid, when I look back at pictures of myself, I was so into fashion. I mean, I can remember being 7 or 8 years old and looking at a brand new pair of shoes that my mother just bought for me, and they were on my feet. And I can actually remember thinking that the toe shape was off by just a little, kind of like a millimeter in today's, now that I think in millimeters at the time, whatever. It was just off a little bit, and it really disturbed me. So I have nieces and nephews who are some not at all into fashion and some they just come out, and my niece's first word was shoe. So I think you're born this way. You're either born in a very visual way and that's what's important to you, or you're born, if you're a musician, in an oral way and that's what's important to you. So I think a lot of this has to do with our personalities. And I fought it for a while, maybe, or maybe I didn't fight it. Maybe I just wasn't thinking about it. I studied architecture at Parsons, and I finally realized that while I loved architecture and it was very useful to me as a tool to learn how to think, that it was a little too serious for me at that moment in time, and that fashion, I was better suited for fashion. I also liked the speed of fashion. Fashion and filmmaking to me were two very, very different things in terms of satisfying a certain kind of creative need, and I hope to be able to make films and produce fashion for the rest of my life, but they're very, very different. Fashion's very quick. It's very disposable. It's immediately it tells you exactly where we are in our culture, especially women's fashion. If we're having a glitzy, over-the-top moment, fashion is very glitzy and over the top. If we're having a moment where things are, we're in a recession, fashion becomes quiet. So in terms of popular culture, fashion, and especially women's fashion, is incredibly interesting. Aside from satisfying just a particular need to create and arrange things in a way that one sees as beautiful. And so in a certain way, it's fulfilling. In another way, it's very fleeting because it doesn't last very long. A beautiful moment in fashion goes away very quickly.
Of all the things that you've designed, do you have any favorites that you really hope will endure because you think they were wonderful?
I do. I have to say, I think my last few collections for Gucci and for Yves Saint Laurent in 2003, 2004, in terms of complexity and construction, were some of the most interesting things I ever designed, because I had learned at that point how to make More complex clothes, both cerebrally as well as technically. And I had worked with a great atelier in Italy for Gucci and in Paris for Saint Laurent. So I had learned a lot. However, the collections that I feel influenced popular culture the most were early on in 1995, 1996. And I think that those are the collections that I'll be remembered for, because at that particular moment in time, fashion was in one place. It was very subdued, very sedated. And in a sense, I brought back sensuality and sexuality to clothes. And the things I did at that time were simpler in construction, but maybe more powerful in content.
Just describe some of the clothes in that collection.
Oh, the first collection I did that really, you know, brought me a lot of attention and brought Gucci a lot of attention and a lot of business were hip huggers in velvet, satin shirts, simple coats. But what was new about them at that time was that they were very, very sensual. They were very colorful as well. It was an enormous amount of color. And they were a throwback to a period in the 1970s when fashion was more touchable. Today, you know, fashion is not – our beauty standard today is harder. It's beautiful, but it's off-putting. It's like, don't touch me. I'm hard. It's so interesting how female form, less male form, mirrors where we are culturally, aesthetically, as well as, for example, right now, everything is pumped up. Cars look like someone took an air pump and pumped them up. They look engorged. Lips pumped up. Breasts pumped up. Everything is pumped up. And it's also kind of off-putting. It's sexual, but in such a hard way that it's, for me, not sexual at all. Whereas the 1970s, breasts were smaller. People were not wearing bras. Farrah Fawcett's sexuality and sensuality was a very touchable sexuality. She was kissable. She was friendly. And that was what I brought back in the 90s with some of my early collections for Gucci that we hadn't seen in a while. And I think that right now we're in a very hard moment and off-putting. I mean, look at shoes today, women's shoes. They couldn't possibly get any higher and meaner and sharper. But then again, you go and watch most films today, they're violent. And we're living in a world that is, at the moment, quite hard.
I love when you say breasts were smaller in the 70s. I mean,
they were.
But
I don't understand all these breasts right now. And they don't look like breasts. They look like someone's taken a grapefruit half and inserted it under your skin. I mean, it doesn't even bear any resemblance to what a natural breast looks like. But we're starting to think that this is what women should look like. And young girls are looking at these breasts and thinking, oh, I need to go have my breasts done, because they've lost touch with what a real breast actually looks like. I find it fascinating. I find it disturbing. I mean, you could consider it more fascinating, because we're becoming post-human. We are actually we are actually starting to manipulate our bodies, because we can, into a shape. We're becoming our own art. But what happens for me is that it desexualizes everything. You know, you start to look more and more polished, more and more lacquered, and you look like a beautiful car. Does anyone want to sleep with you? Does anyone want to touch you? Does anyone want to kiss you? Maybe not, because you're too scary. But you're beautiful, you're glossy, you're shiny, but you're not human. Very interesting. And I say that in a very detached way. I'm not making a judgment about it. I'm just saying it's fascinating culturally.
I just remember thinking, I wonder what you'd say to people, men and women, but I think particularly women, who shop in, you know, in just regular stores, you know, and buy stuff off the rack and find, like, nothing fits, nothing's flattering, nothing's made for their body, that things are made for these perfect sizes that they're not. And because sometimes, like, you shop for clothes and you just have to grit your teeth because there's nothing for you.
Well, and this may sound very spoiled, but I think that something that people in general forget to do, and it's true, not everyone has the financial means to do this. Whatever clothes you buy, if you really want them to fit well, you need to have them altered or tailored. And whether you're doing that yourself, whether you're taking it to your dry cleaner that has a tailor, you need to alter and tailor everything. Whether it's expensive, whether it's whether it's inexpensive. If you want it to really fit your body, even the best clothes have to be tailored.
I think that's good advice.
It's true.
No.
You know, you watch television and you see these actors and they've got a T-shirt on and wow, it's like, that looks amazing. Well, it's been tailored. You know, somebody took it in a little bit here, pulled it in over the arm so that their bicep showed. It's a T-shirt. But, you know, get a sewing machine and run a few simple stitches. Even I can alter my own T-shirt. Not that I do, but I could.
Well, Tom Ford, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Ford, speaking to Terry Gross last December. His first feature film, A Single Man, starring Colin Firth, has just been released on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Tom Ford's feature film debut, A Single Man, came out this week on DVD. We've already heard from Ford himself. Now, let's listen back to Terry's 2009 interview with the star of the film, Colin Firth. Firth is best known for his roles in the films Bridget Jones's Diary, Love Actually, and Mamma Mia, and for his role as Mr. Darcy in the British TV adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. For his starring role in A Single Man, Colin Firth received an Oscar nomination. Our film critic, David Edelstein, called Firth's work in A Single Man the performance of the year. A Single Man is adapted from a novel by Christopher Isherwood, best known for writing the Berlin stories, the basis for the musical and film Cabaret. The movie, directed by fashion designer Tom Ford, is set in 1962. Firth plays George, a gay, middle-aged British man who teaches college in California. His longtime partner has been killed in a car crash. In this flashback from early in the film, George gets the bad news. He's alone at home. His partner is away visiting family. The phone rings.
Finally. You know it's been raining here all day. And I've been trapped in this house waiting for you to call.
I'm sorry, I must have the wrong number. I'm calling for Mr. George Falconer.
I'm sorry, I was expecting someone else. Yes, sir, you have indeed called the correct number. How may I help?
This is Harold Ackerley. I'm Jim's cousin.
Oh, of course. Yes, good evening, Mr. Ackerley.
I'm afraid I'm calling with some bad news.
Huh?
There has been a car accident.
Accident?
There's been a lot of snow here lately, and the roads have been icy. On his way into town, Jim lost control of his car. It was instantaneous, apparently.
Huh.
It happened late yesterday, but his parents didn't want to call you.
I see.
In fact, they don't know that I'm calling you now, but I thought that you should know.
Thank you.
I know this must be quite a shock. It was for all of us.
Yes, indeed. Libya service?
The day after tomorrow.
Well, I suppose I should get off the phone and book a plane flight.
The service is just for family.
For family, of course. Well, thank you for calling. Mr. Ackley.
Yes?
May I ask what happened to the dogs?
Dogs? There was a dog with him, but he died. Was there another one?
Yes, there was a small female.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I haven't heard anyone mention another dog.
Well, thank you for calling, Mr. Ackley.
Goodbye, Mr. Falconer.
That's my guest, Colin Firth, in a scene from A Single Man. And Mr. Ackley, the person on the telephone, was played by John Hamm, so you might have recognized his voice. Colin Firth, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me just describe for our listeners who have not seen the movie what's going on during that phone call and after the phone call in terms of how you are reacting. You're in shock and you're in grief, and it's starting to register on your face. As you get the news, you're breathing deeper, you slightly grimace, your facial muscles tighten, your eyes start to tear. But you're still holding in your emotion. And you're alone in your home. You could let loose without anybody seeing. You could really erupt. You don't. Everything is still pretty held in. Can you talk a little bit about how you decided to play that scene?
I don't think it really came from a decision. I think it was something that seemed natural because of the way it was written, because of the speed with which I felt such news would be processed. You know, there's nothing in the script that says George, you know, breaks down. What I read was what you heard, which was, "Oh, Mr. Ackley, there was another dog in the car. I suppose I should book myself a ticket, and will there be a service?" He's operating as a man still socialized, still observing the rules of courtesy and protocol. Now, to me, looking back on it, I think there's something rather heartbreaking about that, because I think he's hanging on to the world as it was a few seconds ago, when everything was okay, when that's how you behaved and that's how you talked. Everything's actually falling apart completely inside. But I think if he gives in to hysterical misery, then it'll become real, and he's not ready for that. So I didn't really see it as containment. I saw it as just not having got there yet. And something comes to mind here. To me, it echoes some of the observations that Joan Didion wrote about in The Year of Magical Thinking. You know, her husband dies. She records the time of his death. She identifies his body at the hospital. She signs a form. And she's ready to acknowledge the fact that she knows that he's dead. She knows full well that he's gone, but she's not ready to have it announced in the newspaper the next day, because then somehow, if everybody knows about it, it concretizes it in a way that she's not ready for. So I think that something as monumental as the death of somebody very close and very loved isn't something that you react to in a way that's quick or simple.
So much of your acting in A Single Man is about your face. I mean, you have dialogue in it, but there's a lot of silence in the film. There's times when people are talking to you and we're watching you react. So it's about your face and mostly about your eyes. And your eyes are so interesting in this movie because they're so penetrating. Your eyes look like they can see through other people, but at the same time, you have this kind of shield on your own face so that people can't see through you.
Well, I think that a lot of what the film deals with is the body armor that George puts on. I'm sure Tom talked about this. This was something that I think was very much in our minds when we made the film. He has to get through a particular day, and he has to put something in place, which is both a protective mask. In other words, it's something that prevents the rest of the world from seeing how broken he is and how chaotic his true world is. And at the same time, this has to act as a protection against the world trying to come in on him, from the outside world penetrating his very, very vulnerable sensibility. And I think this is where he gets his need to dress perfectly from. This is why he needs to make sure his shoes are shined and that his cufflinks and his tie pin are in place and all of this. I think these are very much acts of desperation. These are things that his life depends on this day. And I think if the eyes are doing anything, it's because it's his day of seeing through that mask. Tom was there to photograph what I was doing, so it gave me a great deal of freedom, gave me a lot of freedom to be silent. As you heard in that phone call, I wouldn't have thought that scene would work on the radio, but it was interesting to listen to how heavy those silences hang. And I think Tom has great faith in stillness and in what the human face can do without a lot of histrionics and without being very, very demonstrative. And for someone whose approach to acting is not that demonstrative, this is a great gift. I felt he played to my strengths.
I just want to get back to the phone call for a second that we opened with. So the actor who is on the phone with you in the scene that we just heard is John Hamm, who plays the leading role in the AMC series Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And he has such a distinctive voice, I kind of recognized it immediately. I think he wasn't quite as famous when he made that scene as he is now. Did you know who he was? Or was he just like a voice on the telephone, or did you just meet him? Was he in another room on the set, or was he like someplace altogether and you never met?
I never met him. I didn't speak to John. I spoke to Chris Weitz, who was one of our producers, who was in the next room on the other end of a phone line. So John came in to do that voice later.
You mean you didn't even shoot the scene with him, with that voice?
No.
Wow.
So that was done on different occasions. So you have him to credit for that, really, because he sounded as very much as if he was there.
Was Chris Weitz, the director, good enough to give you what you needed in that scene? It's such an emotional scene for you. You'd think you'd want the real thing and not a stand-in.
You know, Chris was pretty good.
Yeah?
It wasn't entirely different from what you hear. Mm-hmm. We were both haunted by the moment, so I think Chris was very sensitive, which is what he had to be. But there are a lot of things that didn't help. I mean, that was the day, just before I shot that scene, the sound man took his headphones off and played John McCain's concession speech to the room, because that was the day that we were shooting that. I don't know what your politics are, right? But hearing John McCain conceding defeat was not conducive to tragedy in that moment for me.
So you were elated, and then you had to get tragic news and respond to that.
Exactly. I mean, if we think ourselves back to that moment, it was quite extraordinary, and it felt very special to be in America when that moment happened.
In A Single Man, you play a gay man, a man who seems to be comfortable being gay, but he knows he can't be out to a lot of people, for instance, where he teaches. But there are scenes in which we're seeing other men through the eyes of your character, George. And he's focusing on some of these men in a very erotic way. Mm. And so I'm wondering if in playing the role, since you're not gay, but you were playing a gay man, if you had to start looking at men in a different way and seeing them through the eyes of George.
It's an interesting question. I don't know. I think that, I don't find it to be something that's so very distant. I think you can be very comfortable in your sexuality and find people of both sexes attractive and appealing. So I don't think, in the scene where I'm having to look at the tennis players, and I wasn't looking at tennis players really, I was looking at some electricians probably.
this is a scene where everything seems to, someone's talking to you about the threat of nuclear war or something, and you're gazing at these two men playing tennis, and you're gazing them with some amount of awe and longing because they're so beautiful. As they play.
Well, that wasn't what I was looking at on the day, and I can tell you I did not find the electricians attractive at all. I actually think, now it's coming back to me, I think Tom had a couple of the guys playing tennis players sort of stand in. In tennis, they were there to shoot their scene, so he thought, well, we might as well have them standing there for an island. I remember thinking, now, is this helping? I'm looking at guys. The electricians didn't work, and I'm not sure the guy in the tennis gear works anyway. Now I'm beginning to get confused. So I don't know. It's an interesting question to ask about acting generally. I mean, if you're playing someone that is obsessed with collecting stamps or is power-crazed or, I don't know, is determined to, climb Mount Everest, I don't have to have those particular passions in me. In order to be able to play that part, I have to find passion from somewhere. And somehow I have to make that translate as that passion. So I think, whatever you're doing, it's never going to be entirely you, and the character's preoccupations orientations are never going to have to be exactly what yours are.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Colin Firth, who's now starring in the film A Single Man. Now, you grew up in a bunch of places, Nigeria, the United States, several places in England. You were in India for a while, too?
I didn't go to India.
You didn't go to India, but your parents grew up in India.
My parents were born and raised in India. I still haven't been, which is increasingly peculiar if you know my family, because I really am the only member of the family that hasn't been. I'm nearly 50, and I still owe that trip.
And it was the fact that I think that your grandparents were missionaries that
yes.
led to your parents living in India and then Nigeria?
That's correct. My paternal grandfather started as a missionary. He joined the British Missionary Society because he heard that they were building schools and hospitals in India. He was not evangelical. He didn't go around converting people. In fact, he was very proud of the fact that he never converted a single person. His wife was also an ordained minister. He then took the decision to train as a doctor and came to the United States and took his family to a medical school in Iowa for 8 years, and then returned to India as a doctor specializing in osteopathy, and would go off for 6 months around into the mountains and cure as many people as he could.
And what about your parents?
My parents grew up there. My mother, I think, didn't come to England at all until she was about 16. Because of what her father was doing, she spent 8 years of school in the United States in Iowa, in a place called Ankeny. And my parents knew each other since they were very small because they grew up together in South India. My father became a history lecturer, and my mother has taught and lectured in all sorts of things, comparative religion and the study of other faiths. She is a person who I think has a great belief in the contemplative lifestyle. She practices meditation. She, I think, is a real searcher.
Do you practice meditation?
No, not seriously. I've just sort of tried to learn to be quiet a little bit. I actually went to a monastery. This was a Buddhist monastery to learn something about meditation. And I have never practiced it with any great discipline, but I did find it to be, even in its probably shallowest and least disciplined form, I did find it to be somewhat helpful. Because however fortunate my lifestyle is, it's not always the most restful.
What made you go in the first place to the Buddhist monastery? What did you want?
Restfulness. I suppose it was this sense that I've always been very attracted to the randomness and the unpredictability of my profession. I enjoy not knowing what's next. I enjoy the passionate commitment to something which is going to be gone soon. It's a strange creative promiscuity, if you like, where I'll move on to the next thing and commit myself with equal, immersion and delight in something as if the one before just never existed. And I think that it's very exciting, but it can create a kind of upheaval because there's no continuity. And however thrilled I am by what I'm doing and however stimulated I am by it, I think it's it can be quite difficult to get back to a sort of a core. One of the things you're doing is taking on different people's lives. You're changing character. You're changing personalities. You're not always, I find it's not always easy to shake them off. And before you've shaken one off, you're taking another one on. And I think just for an actor, just to get back to a sense of who you are without all of that, I think can be quite a challenge.
I hate to end here, but we're out of time. Colin Firth, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Colin Firth, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His movie, A Single Man, co-starring Julianne Moore, came out on DVD this week. Annette Bening and Julianne Moore play a lesbian couple raising a family in the new movie The Kids Are All Right. Their everyday life is interrupted by the appearance of their children's sperm donor. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
In 1967, in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, white Catherine Ross brought black fiancé Sidney Poitier to visit parents Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And though the film was a creaky sitcom, it captured something of mainstream culture's imminent upheaval. Now comes Lisa Cholodenko's The Kids Are All Right, another situation comedy, a stupendous one that shakes up our way of looking at the family. The parents are a same-sex couple, Nick and Jules. They're women. And the guess who comes to dinner is their anonymous sperm donor, located by their two teenage children, Joni and Laser. Each mother carried a child, so they both received his contribution, but neither expected him to be an influence on her kids. Annette Bening's Nick is a doctor and more the authority figure, and Bening wears a short, fluffy haircut, lowers her voice, purging its tinkle, and presents to her kids a mask of stability, of someone who values structure above all. Nick doesn't articulate her political agenda, but it's implicit that two moms can create a home that's every bit as traditional as one with a mother and father. She is admirable, but also a bit of a pill. And Bening has a genius for illuminating the gap between the facade and the person underneath, desperately trying to hold the mask in place. Like the best comic protagonists, Nick takes herself too seriously, which guarantees her orderly universe will become untethered. Enter Mark Ruffalo as Paul, the freewheeling hetero bachelor restaurateur. Over the meal, Nick wears a frozen smile, but questions him with visible distaste. But there are frequent cuts to the fascinated kids, Mia Wasikowska's studious Joni and Josh Hutcherson's Laser, who's struggling in school, doing drugs, unable to conform to Nick's view of him. Although he doesn't speak here, he's especially taken by his bio dad's view of higher education.
So, Paul, did you always know that that you wanted to be in the food services industry?
I always liked food.
No, I was asking because I remember when I was reading your file back when we were looking for, sperm. Sure. Anyway, you said that you were studying international relations.
Oh, yeah, wow, that was a long time ago. Yeah, I was considering it, but then I dropped out of school.
Oh. You dropped out of college?
Yeah, it just wasn't my thing.
No, huh? Why's that?
I don't know, it just seemed like a massive waste of money after a while, you know? I was just sitting on my ass listening to people spout ideas I could just as easily have learned in a book.
Oh, okay.
I'm not saying that I think that higher learning uniformly blows.
Oh.
You know, I think college is great for some people. Joni, I'm sure you're going to love it. But just, I'm a doer. That's how I learn. That's just me. I'm weird that way, I guess.
Director Lisa Cholodenko is best known for the amusing, though finally tragic, lesbian love story High Art. But for The Kids Are All Right, she collaborated with a more commercial screenwriter, Stuart Blumberg. They contrive a flirtation between Paul and Jules, played by Julianne Moore, whose lyric ditheriness carries echoes of Diane Keaton. But as a duettist, Moore is in a class of her own. She takes on the rhythms of her co-stars, suggesting how marriage to the strong-willed Nick has kept Jules soft and suggestible. It's easy to see why Paul charms her, since Ruffalo has a magnetic flakiness, and when Paul tries to reach out to his newfound family, he's touchingly awkward. The kid actors are more than all right. The watchful Wasikowska shows the wheels turning in Joni's head, trying to reassemble the puzzle pieces of her life, and Hutcherson lets you glimpse the person fighting to emerge from under layers of defenses. Cholodenko has a female partner and a child, and in a political climate hostile to gay families, it must be hard for her even to suggest that two moms might not be enough. But she's a true dramatist. She tests what is presumably her own design for living. She bombards it with every satirical weapon in her arsenal. Then she picks up the pieces and rebuilds. But Chaladenko also wants you to see that despite the gaps in the pioneer family life of Nick and Jules, Joni and Laser have enough of a foundation, enough love, to grope their way to all rightness. The self-satire of The Kids Are All Right is so rich, so hilarious, so healthy, you wonder how anyone could find a reason to vote against it.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.